If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Sally Maver is a mixed media artist who, for over 40 years, has been creating vignettes featuring small dolls and wonderful worlds that have become much loved in the world of book publishing. Sally's work is joyful and creative and evocative and a perfect fit for a lot of the children's books that she's been involved in. Yet, within her work, as well as joy, there is darkness. And Sally's work has often touched on political themes and themes about personal experience as much as it has creating fantastical worlds. This is the first part of our needle exchange, and we have a great chat about how Sally came to be the artist that she was meant to be. And to be honest, it sounds like she pretty much came out of the park swinging. She had very supportive parents who encouraged her to make the work that she wanted to make. And when she got to art college and was given the choice to do 3D textiles, everything fell into place and she really hasn't looked back. It's wonderful chatting with Sally. It's wonderful chatting with someone who's managed to forge a career doing the thing that they were meant to do for such a long time. Sally's books take years to complete and prepare and make, and yet these worlds that she creates are filled with joy and wonder and a timeless quality that really, it just fits, you know, textile art and these kind of books, they're just a perfect match, and Sally's been able to make a career out of this. She is much loved all over the world, and I think once you've heard this part of our needle exchange, you will understand why. Thank you to Sally for being part of the conversation. And if you have enjoyed this, please do share it with one other person who you think will also enjoy this conversation. We'll be back next week with the second part of our needle exchange. So until then, enjoy the show. So this is your well-renowned workshop, of which I've seen many photos.
Yeah, I live here.
Is it like a portal? Is it a bit like, you know, the back of the wardrobe in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe? Like, you walk through your house and then suddenly you enter Sally's house and you enter Sally's world.
Yes, it is a little bit like that. And it's in a, so over in my garage, and there's two entrances. You can go in from the outside, downstairs, up the stairway, but it's also connected to the upstairs of my house, and I go through an actual door into here, and it's totally separate from the rest of the house, but it's close. And it is something that I've always had a studio. I've always been lucky enough to have a separate room, but this came a little later. It was just this unfinished space over our garage. Bats were flying around in it. And my husband said, you know, you really should, we should make that into your studio. And I said, oh, it's much too big. I mean, I used to have this.
That's very humble of you.
I can't be in such a large space. And he just kept at me. And finally I said, okay, we'll do it. And so we renovated it and made it into what could be an apartment. It actually has hookups for gas and water, but and a bathroom. But I don't think I'll ever make it into an apartment while I'm alive anyway. And it's going to be my studio. And it was no problem moving in here, filling the space, even though I only work in a very small area on my table. Actually, I just work in my hands.
Right, yeah.
I just have stuff all around me, materials as well as just inspiration, things I like.
Do you think there's a risk that the tiny creations you're making may just take over and eventually the whole place will just become like a universe?
It is. It is now. If you could come in here now, you would see that it is. It is a universe. It's like one of my art pieces, but a room. And that's how I'm thinking about art shows now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have a show in about 3 years, and I'm thinking more about making the whole space into a world that you go into. I mean, there's no way that I'll have in my lifetime have enough time to do that in my scale, but I'm thinking in those terms of creating it as a piece of art, have the room as a piece of art.
Because you could scale up, couldn't you? I know yours is all of your work on the same scale? Roughly.
It is, but I have done some larger things, and it's the tendency is to go small. Though I just keep moving small, so I have to expand. I have to think totally differently, and it's uncomfortable for me. But I'm going to really try.
You said somewhere I read an interview that basically you've managed to make playing with dolls' houses into a profession for approximately 40 years now.
Yes, right. So true.
Can you, would you like to tell us the whole story of how you came to be the creator of, I like to think of them as, they're like charming vignettes. You use a bas relief style. I know you like to use that. I remember, I think when you were on Gail's podcast, you were talking about how stump work just really doesn't sound as good as it ought to be. So you've got a bas relief style, vignettes. Yeah, I mean, tell me the story. Tell me the story of
okay,
how it came to be.
Okay, are we recording now?
Oh, we've been recording for 5 minutes.
Oh, okay, all right.
We're in. We are in.
We are in.
Please do tell the tale of how you came to be the maker of the worlds that you make.
The maker of the worlds I make. Well, I get that question a lot. Like, where did this come from? Like, where did you come up with this? Or where did you learn it? It just is me. This is who I am. And I've always been since I was a child. I've always been fascinated with little things and worlds and dollhouses and since my earliest memories. And I actually have spent my whole life envisioning and figuring out how to make these dolls that I just wanted. I yearned for. I yearned to make this world, and it started so young. I mean, my mother must have influenced me a lot. She was an artist, and she was always making things in all kinds of mediums, crafts, as well as fine art. And so for me, it was just totally normal to make things. And I felt as a child making drawing with crayons that, I mean, I like to do that. I like to draw, but it wasn't enough. I mean, I needed something real in there. So I would cut out felt or cardboard or other kinds of construction paper or beads or seeds, and I would glue things, I would staple things, I would make collages. To me, that was much more engaging than using just a crayon. That was just flat. That wasn't real. I wanted to make something real.
And that was something you could really like feel, like you felt complete or something.
I could hold it in my hand,
right?
Basically. So it wasn't like, it's the distance between my hand and the paper, if I had a crayon or a pencil, was too long.
Right.
I had to actually hold it in my hand because that's what happens. It just comes through me, through my hands. Of course, I use my brain too, but it's like, my hands are doing it. I'm just following where my hands lead. So as far as learning techniques, that's how I've done it. I have not taken classes. I've just learned from seeing diagrams and simple little instructions in booklets, and then taking it where I want to go and figure it out as I go. And that's what makes it interesting. So I've always made things, and when came time to figure out what to do with my life, I wasn't even sure if I wanted to be an artist. But that was ridiculous. Why did I even think that I wasn't going to be an artist? Of course I was. And I mean, that's what makes me happy. That's the natural place. I mean, I couldn't imagine being in a job where I had to wear pantyhose. I mean, no way. No way was I going to do that. But I have been so fortunate to be able to be an artist and to do the work that I do on my own terms. And the way I want it to be. I mean, I've worked in children's book illustration, which has its own constraints, but I have been able to forge a path, my own path, even in that industry. So, when it came time to go to school or figure out what to do after high school, I went to art school and. I really still had my own idea about what I wanted in my head, but it wasn't translating into the structure of art school.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pick your department, ceramics, jewelry, painting, sculpture. What I had in mind was totally unique in a way, even textiles at that time. I wasn't interested in weaving or fabric design, which was what was available. The term fiber art didn't exist at that time. And I knew I wanted to communicate. I wanted to do narrative work. I wanted to be able to tell a story. So that's what led me to the illustration department. So I thought, I will do that. And I really tried to do the more traditional mediums, paint the painting and the drawing, and I can do it, but I wasn't able to kind of create this world that it was talking about that medium. And my teacher, one of my teachers was especially supportive. She would see me sitting in class making little things. I always had something going on with my fingers. Got to keep them busy because these classes were really boring. I mean, they were critiques that went on and on about people's art. And most people just in the class didn't care about anybody else's art. They were just waiting for their piece to be talked about.
Right.
And so my teacher noticed this and she came over and said, you know, this is what you should be doing. Try this in your illustration assignment. So I just let go of the whole idea of being more of a traditional illustrator. And I started doing my assignments by sewing, making dolls, setting them up, making embroidering fabric. And it was as if I was being set free. I felt that I was now able to become the kind of artist that I was meant to be. And it was like flying. It was just effortless. I was not struggling. It was like, it was play. It was like the feeling I had as a child. But I still had to do the assignment and do it within certain rules about communication. I mean, the whole idea was to communicate and have it in a form that people could get. So I kind of like that. I like that kind of structure. And I like the idea of an assignment and some place to sort of focus your attention and skills. So that's really how I became a children's book illustrator. I learned how to do that. And then since then I've branched off and I do standalone pieces. I've done lots of different projects, in my career.
I love the fact, like you say, it was just like a release. It was just like someone almost opened some gates or gave you some walking shoes and just let you go rambling because you'd already got this idea. And it sounds like there was very little uncertainty from your standpoint, almost like you were just waiting to be released.
Yes, I think so. I had been doing this on my own, making things. It was partly sort of the expectation of the classrooms and these certain classes you take that you make art that kind of fit within that. And part of it was myself holding myself back or thinking I had to be somebody different. Mm. And like, if I couldn't draw like Arthur Rascom, is that his name? The children's book illustrator. Okay. Or, you know, somebody who was just really, really good, then why do it? Right. You know, it's like the world doesn't need another children's book illustrator who draws well. I mean, it's like there's tons of them out there.
Mm.
Instead of like, I was going to bring something unique, something that was more myself, that was just coming out of myself. And that's another thing that people ask about. Where do you get your inspiration? Where do your ideas come from?
Mm.
And I keep thinking about that. And actually, the growth and children, I have these little baby grandchildren who are growing, and they're, and you know how people use this term, they're like sponges, they absorb.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking that it's actually the opposite. They are who they are, and they are learning the skills to let themselves out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I feel. I feel like I am who I am. I was as a baby, and it's learning how to live in this world and communicate that and to express that. And so this whole medium that I've devised and worked with is just a continuation of that, of my trying to get it out of me from inside out. So it's not like things are coming at me or I'm influenced by this or inspired by this. It's something different.
And there is no doubt, like you never, like you said earlier, you know, there'll not be a job where you're doing pantyhose. There's not a part of you that secretly yearns to be like an accountant or anything. This is like, this is the only thing Sally can do, end of story.
Well, in some ways, life would be easier if I had those aspirations. But I think I've always known that I could. I wasn't really normal like that.
Mm.
And I think that most people, when it really gets down to it, don't think they're normal. I mean, nobody thinks they're normal.
Mm.
We are all unique. And so I have this sort of unconventional approach, which feels right to me.
Mm.
That's kind of the culture and the family that I grew up in.
Well, I think that was what I was going to ask. It seems like that's an important part of it. The fact that your parents never really said you had to deviate from that course.
No. They were really hands-off. I think that was more of a generational thing, too,
right,
compared to what you see now with parents, helicopter parents. I mean, they were dealing with their own stuff.
Mm.
Family of three kids, we all did very different things, and we just, without hardly any direction for
right.
our
well,
parents.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, so what do your siblings do?
My brother was a computer programmer; he's retired, and my sister is an artist.
Okay,
but I come from a family of kind of esoteric intellectual. Really kind of sort of, it's really hard to describe. But
yeah. But your middle name is Rainbow, that sort of thing.
Well, I don't know. Yeah.
No, but I think that's great, because I think the problem is we just get entrenched in these ways of doing things, don't you? You know, and like, you know, I'm a dad now. My daughters, both of those, you see the things that interest them. And I think there's like the old... the old modes as well that said you've got to go to university to study a thing, even that seems to be dissolving around us because of the complexities and the cost. So I think it's quite bold to allow your children the freedom to pursue their dreams. The one thing I admire is the fact that, and it's clearly so strong in you, is the fact that you never, like, the things you loved when you were a child, you held on to, and you, that love continued. I worry my children now, that, like, Flora in particular loves animals, wants to be a vet. I worry in 10 years' time she's going to be like, oh, I want to be a YouTuber or something trivial, and we'll have lost the inherent thing that brings her that joy now. And it's great to see that you just held on to it and you still haven't let go of that.
Yeah, it's pretty strong, and I think I'm kind of stubborn that way, but it's so tied to my sense of well-being that it's more, it's like not a choice. And I think other artists will say the same thing. I'm totally driven. This is all I want to do, all I think about. But I have to kind of I have to engage with the world. And it's like, so, I mean, I do pay attention to my husband. And I mean, I'm this grandmother, and I am lucky enough to have a little toddler who can come over every day. So it's like, it's such a joy. And, it's feeding some other part of me that my art would have taken in the past. But now it's like, oh, yes, this is so good. So I am multifaceted. I maintain my friendships, but I am an introvert. I think that most artists probably would say that, and not really a team player at all. I just do my own thing.
Yeah. So let's talk about the intricacies. You said once as well that you only know 6 stitches. Now I'm wondering, when I look at your work, I wrote down that you're like a kind of a technical expert, because you make vignettes, you make book illustrations, you tell stories, you create all these worlds, and you create all these different aspects of this world. So then for you to say you only know 6 stitches, I was a little bit flabbergasted, because I sort of feel like you know them all.
Well, I think they're all variations of about 6 stitches.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I probably do know a lot of stitches, but I don't know what their names are. And I didn't actually learn them by, you know, somebody teaching me or a book. I mean, besides the daisy chain and, you know, the blanket stitch and that kind of thing. They're all just variations of that, just different combinations of that. And I'm not really interested in stitching, believe it or not.
Right.
It's like, to me, it is a way of communicating an idea. It's a way of making a line. It's a way of putting color in and texture. And that, my goal is to make a piece of art that communicates something. And so, yes, there is the process part, and the engaging with the materials part. And those are all important, because it takes so much time. You have to like doing it. And I do. I get a lot out of the process. But I'm thinking all the time while I'm working and planning out what's happening next, because I'm figuring it out as I go.
Yeah.
It's not like, that's why I could never do cross stitch, because it's all laid out in a grid. You know ahead of time what it's going to be. And for me, it doesn't work. I have to be able to move things around, change my mind, change it. And that's what's also great about stitches, because you can just pull out the thread and start over again. So it's working within the constraints of a lot of the needlework industry, of the cross stitch or following a pattern, that isn't what I'm interested in. And I know that it's like this whole industry out there that sort of feeds into that. Mm. And I think that people get a lot of comfort and satisfaction out of doing that. Mm-hmm. But I get comfort and satisfaction out of making things that are just a little bit more open and free and playful.
Yeah. And they definitely are that. I think that's what's amazing. But what's interesting from what you've just said there, though, is your constraints then, I guess, form within the realms of like the storytelling and telling that part of the story, right? Because then you've got lots of room to play within that. But I guess still there's those. Do you sort of intuitively feel when the language you're communicating is coming through properly?
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, I really work away. It's all intuitive. And also to create emotion, that's another one of my goals, is to bring emotion in and movement. And because needlework can be very static. Mm-hmm. So I try to create drama and movement, which is it's a real challenge. I mean, a lot like watercolor, which is all flowy, or, you know, this has definite edges to it. Mm. So it's all about design and composition. That sort of feeds into what I am trying to create, which is to make something that somebody can see from a distance and be attracted to and curious about, and then want to go in and look at it and find out what it is. And then once they're there, then you can kind of complete the story, and you don't have, and then they can see all the details.
Yeah, because your pieces, I mean, one of the things that I feel is that you've got a certain vernacular in the way, you know, your choice of characters are there. It's a similar technique. It's kind of, I might be wrong on this, but it's kind of like peg dolls, isn't it? They're kind of like fairly fundamental characters, and obviously you shape them and you create them and you tell stories with them. But inherent to that and inherent to the materials you use, there's like this built-in charm. There's this built-in familiarity. There's this built-in nostalgia. So that lends itself really well to children's books. But also, like you say, you can put drama into these situations as well, which presumably gets amplified because you get that contrast between like the form and the content. Does that seem reasonable?
Yes. Yes. Oh yeah. I think you really summed it up there. And this is something that I never could have planned. And it has evolved over time. And as I has been working and creating these characters, I mean, I've had the sense for years that these characters could say so much more, and than I was doing in my sort of, you know, bucolic and childlike scenes. I mean, I can do that, but there's, I mean, it's got to put a punch in there. I've been wanting to do that for a while. Yeah. And so that was maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I started sort of bringing in the real world into my art, and found it just so satisfying to do that. And something that I thought, if I'm ever going to do that, I have to do it now. I have to start doing it and not be afraid of sort of saying something.
Yeah, because it's quite tricky, isn't it? Because you've got this style and it lends itself really well to the children's books illustration, which is where you can see the beauty of it. You can see the joy in the work. You can see the pieces that you create and how they work. They are just, you know, you've got the nursery rhymes books. You've got the one about the way that people, the bed book. The bed book, that's what it's called, isn't it?
Yeah, it's my bed.
Yeah, and... like, so there's a real joy in that. And then I think that's what makes it interesting, particularly if you go through, say, your Instagram feed, is you've got joy, joy, oh, darkness, joy, joy. And it's a relief to see, because I think you would run the risk, if you didn't do that, of it always being quite vanilla. And while there's nothing wrong with vanilla, it's nice to be a bit like mint choc chip sometimes, isn't it?
Yes. But there is a sort of a way that I feel that I can do it that is different than other artists. And some of the stuff you see out there just like makes you cringe and makes you want to look away and is just sort of assaulting, like visually assaulting or grotesque.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't do that. Mm. I'm not going to do that. And it's like, I want people to look at what I'm making. I want them to feel invited. But there's sometimes I'm going to be expressing something or saying something that they don't expect. But I want them there. I want them to see it and not have to turn away.
Mm.
And so that's sort of why I've been able to make my art still cute, but and I use that term like I just because I'm sure that people criticize what I do and saying, oh, it's just too cute, and don't take me seriously because of that.
Mm.
But some of my work, if they really saw it, and they would say, yeah, it's cute, but
yeah, and
there's something going on there.
Yeah, I think that's the secret sauce. You know, that's the thing that I like. It was making me think about when Steven Spielberg made Jaws and the fact that he couldn't get a shark, you know, couldn't get the shark to look realistic, couldn't get the shark to do the things they wanted to do. So they had to use other techniques like shooting from the perspective of the shark up. So you see people swimming above you. And the amount of tension and terror that creates is so much greater than seeing the shark swimming through the water. Do you know what I mean? And it's you've got that opportunity, haven't you? Because you can slide darkness into a scene where people on face value aren't expecting it.
Yes. And sometimes I really have to push myself to do that. When I made my piece Displaced, which is Refugees.
Right.
I kept telling myself, just make it darker, bring in more black, make it just make it more angular, make it sharp. And I just, because I have a tendency to make things soft and round, I had to kind of push myself. Okay, it's got a point to it. It's like it's got a force, but it still has a quality, like a dollhouse miniature quality to it.
That's your vernacular, isn't it? That's your the visual signifiers,
right? Because I know it's balance. It's trying to get the balance right.
Mm. Do you find? I mean, do those pieces? Obviously, I know that you're prompted by external events, but do those pieces sort of come to the surface over time? Do you find that, for instance, if you were doing another book, and I know that your books take, is it about 3 years, isn't it, from conception to execution all the way through? Over that time, do you find these other ideas like bubbling to the surface? Because it's almost like you need a little bit of rebalance or something.
Yes. Oh, definitely. I actually have decided not to do any more children's books just because of the time that it takes. And also, I have ideas all the time. No problem with ideas. It's sort of like if I have a day, even an hour, where I'm not, don't have to do something, an idea will shoot right in there. But then it will take so long to execute it. So I'm trying to be able to have that going on because it's so exciting. Have these new ideas coming in at the same time as making something that takes months and months and months and months that I have to focus on. Mm. So it's also a balance of figuring that out and making things that I want is to make for friends, or I make these little banners or for friends who have new children or grandchildren. And I really want to make these and give them as gifts, but that's not, you know, making
a 10-minute
art
job, is it?
That makes a big difference in the world. This is like But I still want to do that. So I have to
put
time aside, and I will just focus on that. And so it's as I've gotten older, I'm much more willing to just say no to things.
Mm.
I say, no more children's books, no more fairies, no more fairy kits. It's time to move forward and do this. Always growing, always trying new things.
Mm. How do you capture those ideas? And when an idea comes in, is there a way that you're able to put it somewhere that satisfies or like scratches the itch for now so you can park it and finish things?
Well, if I'm smart, I will draw something in my in my sketchbook. But I'm not always doing that. There are a lot of things that are totally lost.
Mm.
But it sort of it percolates there in the brain, and will come out in different ways. It's still, if I had an idea, it's still in there, just may need something else to get it into some form that can be presented.
And so I suppose it's interesting then, because if you're in the production process of something with a deliberate goal, and I've said this before just about cross-stitching, you know, cross-stitching is really meditative. You don't have to think too hard about it because you're just following a pattern. And so that frees up, like, I'm going to say that bit of your brain, and then allows the other bit of your brain space to roam, because you can just do those things. Despite the complexity of the work that you're producing and the problem solving that you're doing, I'm guessing somewhere there's still that portion of your brain where the ideas are, like you say, percolating away at the back.
Yes. It is. And another real advantage to working on a slow process or slow art, whatever they call it these days, is that I can change things. I can develop my ideas while I'm working. And I can just keep working away. And I guess artists have always done that. I mean, you think of a painter who sort of with those spending time just in standing in front of their painting with slashes of color all over it. And they're still looking at it and thinking of and strategizing. But I just do that in a much, much slower way and through my hands. But I will be able to make judgments about what direction to go in, or this or that. Sometimes they're just very technical, like color and contrast and those kind of decisions.
So when you're doing a book illustration, when you're doing a children's book, it's kind of sequential a lot of the time, isn't it? Because you're telling a story. When you're making the pieces, do you make them in the order of the story? Now, I know some of the books don't go like that. Some of the books are just individual vignettes that you can kind of shape as you want. But if you're doing a sequential story, would you do it in the sequence that it happens? So decisions you make early on, you don't have to retrofit other panels. Does that make sense? That kind of question.
Retrofit.
You know, so for instance, if a third of the way through the book you went, actually, I've decided that this should go like this, and then, you know, does that have a reverse knock-on consequence?
Oh, okay. Well, it's been a while since I've done one of those kind of stories, but everything is all laid out in the, what they call the dummy, which is drawings. So I have to do, like, any illustrator, I have to draw out how the pages are going to look and where the important elements are going to be. The house is here, the person's there, the tree's there. But it can shift a little and change a little, and the detail can come in later. But it has to actually fit the page. You're working with a certain size page. So there are these constraints, and I like that. I like kind of working within that. And then when I'm working on the piece, I do not have to stay in the order of the beginning of the story to the end.
Right.
I've already done that with the drawing. Right. It's all been designed. It's all about what I want to do first. What I'm excited about. Because I know it's a long haul. I have years. I'm going to be working on this book for years.
Yeah.
So I have to keep the excitement inside me, my desire to actually work. Mm-hmm. So that's how I do it. I just take, I'm excited about this, I want to do this, I'll do that.
So a lot of the decision making, a lot of the backwards and forwards with like the book publisher or how your editor would be done in the like the thumbnail and the dummy stage,
yes.
And then you're
everything is all done ahead. And I have been very fortunate that the editors I've worked with have given me a lot of scope because of my technique. Mm. I think they're kind of intimidated. They do not know what I'm going to make, but they trust me,
yeah.
And they have to make it work.
Yeah.
Some editors would want to be involved all the time and just sort of tweaking this and tweaking that, and that's what they're used to. But it wouldn't that kind of doesn't work with me.
Yeah. And then how do you cope with the point in the project? I guess I call it the dip. There's always that bit. I don't know, 60-70% of the way through when it's feeling like it's taking its toll and you still can carry on. Have you got any tips for getting through that?
The dip.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I've really experienced it that way, because, or maybe that there are frequent times all along the process when I have uncertainty.
Right.
I mean, I was going to use the word doubt, but I don't think that comes in. It's more uncertainty of which direction to go in.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to push myself to work through it.
Mm.
So it's to solve the problem, really. And all I have to, and I've done it enough so that when that comes up, it's familiar. It's like, okay, here we are again. This is what I have to do. I have to push through. I've done it before. I know I can do it. I just have to do that. And that's what gets me through to the next stage.
It's making me think of that Simon Garfunkel song, "Hello, Darkness, My Old Friend."
Yes, right.
Here we go. Because I think sometimes I had an experience a few years ago where I had to go on like live national radio. And that was kind of a big deal because it was like one of the BBC channels. And it was fun to go to like that layer of nervousness, because in some ways, you know, those are your growth points, aren't they, when you're pushing through those?
Right. Yes. Yeah. And then you did it.
Yeah.
And now you can add it to your list. I did it.
It's marvelous.
Yeah.
But no, it was kind of cool, because the thing is I've done, I can talk like easily about a lot of stuff, but it was nice to be that nervous again. And I think sometimes me and my wife in our early courting days went and did ballroom dancing evening classes. Now, if ever there was a situation where I was out of my comfort zone, it was that. But I look back on that with fondness now, because I just think you kind of suffer your way through it and you come out the other side and you've grown. And it may not be the same with those points of uncertainty that you talk about, because I can tell that fundamentally you're like, I'm going forwards, you know, there's no stopping. This is kind of guaranteed. But presumably the more comfortable and confident you get with your technique and your process, then those moments of uncertainty are the interesting points.
Yes. And I think when you were talking about the nervousness, for me, I mean, when I work, I'm totally chill. This is so relaxing what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have been on TV. I have done in interviews, and we're doing this interview today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a totally different experience than making art.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that it's something that I actually am, what's the right word? There's a part of me that really likes this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I say that I'm an introvert, yeah, I definitely am an introvert. But I care enough about my art to want to communicate about it. It means enough to me. What I'm doing means enough to me. And I see that there's value in talking to people about it and sharing it. And if it takes doing these interviews and giving talks and giving a talk next week, this is how I share myself with the world.
Mm.
But it's in a context where I know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this, I, is I'm living this world. And it's not like I'm trying to be something different or put on a show or a performance. This is real to me. Mm. And so with this nervousness that you talk about, I'm thinking if I do get nervous, sometimes it comes up, it's because I really care. Mm-hmm. I really want it to go well. And I want to be able to communicate succinctly and clearly to people. Mm. I don't want to muck it up. Mm. It's too important to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think sometimes as well, it's like public speaking that petrifies a lot of people, and I've done plenty of it. But even when I go and do a talk, I think if you're not a little bit nervous about that stuff, then you probably oughtn't do it anymore, because I don't think you do care. You know, you've got to have those kind of butterflies one way or the other. It's all part of the process.
Right. Right.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's needle.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.